Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 213. How you doing? Thank you all for tuning in and for all the love for last week's episode with Jamie Demetriou of the amazing Staff Let's Flats, a TV series on Channel 4. The first episode starts tonight, and honestly, it's genius. It's 10 p.m. on Channel 4. You're going to love it, Staff Let's Flats. But this week's guest is Kate Nash, and it's one that I've been promising for a long time. I've known Kate for many, many years, but haven't seen her for kind of more years than I knew her, I think it was. So we were delighted when the promotion team who were in charge of her promotion run for Glow, season two, hit me up asking if I'd have her on the podcast. And I was like, yeah, that's my pal. It'll be lovely. So it was genuinely a beautiful catch up. I should mention at this point, I mean, we talk about the music industry and independent music and the changes in the music industry. So this is a great point to mention that this week's podcast is brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com, where you can get tons of my music, the music of bands on my label. You can get merch. You can get my live Edinburgh Fringe show on DVD or digital download. And loads of good stuff. Obviously, we talk about the Edinburgh Fringe in this podcast as well. It comes up all too often. It annoys people because I love the Fringe. But yeah. So yeah, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Head over there now. This podcast, as said, if you've tuned in for the first time, go and check out the episode a while back with Gemma Carney and the episode with Laura Dockrill, because they're both people that kind of knocked about in the scene with me and Kate, and Jack Pignatti and Adele and Peggy Sue and the Pirates and Stuart James and loads of good people, Piers, Aslan, all that crowd. So yeah, have a look at them. I want to clarify at the beginning here, because there's a bit I'm going to clarify at the end, and there's a bit at the beginning I want to clarify. We touched briefly on the acting industry, and I was saying that it's a weird thing, because I've come into the acting industry in recent years. I did a show on FX in America and a show on the BBC over here and a film with Fox recently. And it's a weird time, because I've come into the acting industry as a white male, and it's the first time in history where I'm a complete film and TV nerd, so I'm keeping an eye on all the news, always have been, about what films are coming, what projects are coming, and so many of the exciting, vibrant, new, original-sounding projects are casts made up largely of people of colour or largely of women. And as as someone who wants to get in amazing projects, it's mildly annoying on my part, but the annoyance is outweighed by how exciting it is to have new voices. And it's genuinely, anyone who's kind of feels that there's a negativity of over compensating for previous lack of representation, you're wrong. The film industry in particular, it's been amazing for years and years and years. But there's always that thought of, at some point, people are going to run out of stories, right? I know that sounds ridiculous, because they never will, but look at how many films are being remade at the moment and sequels of previous films. It suggests that people are running out of stories, but that's because for so long, the voice telling the stories, the perspective these stories are coming from, have largely been a white males, a higher percentage. I'm not saying only, but a higher percentage. So to add the original new voices of black writers, of female writers, of Asian writers, of all sorts of different cultures and areas, that's going to be exciting new stories that aren't retreading the same old ground. So yeah, I think it's a positive thing. And another example I wanted to give, I was trying to think of the best way to explain it, because people often argue, I'm all for equality, but I just think the best person for the job should get the job. And of course that's logical, but what you're failing to look at there is the fact that previously that hasn't been the case. Now, the main arguments against both equality racially and equality, gender equality. The main arguments that come up, not against them, but the main arguments that come up, is that it's exaggerated how much inequality there is. Now, that's an argument that can go back and forth for ages. What I think is unarguable is that in the past, it has been very male-dominated and white male-dominated. I think that's unarguable. There has been, obviously, inequality. I mean, there was slavery, for fuck's sake, and women previously didn't have the vote. So that part, that's unarguable, that at one point in time, it was very male, better for you to be a male and better for you to be a white in the world in general. Now, the argument on how much that's leveled out is a complex one, and that's not one that I'm going to get into. I think it's inarguable that it won't have been solved yet. I think anyone who's against feminism or not against but gets angry about it is when they feel it's being over-exaggerated, the state we're in at the moment. Again, I don't know stats on that. I think stats are hard to get because stats are always representative of a pool rather than of the whole. It's impossible to get stats of the whole because that's every person in the world in every role. But the thing that I feel is because of that waiting in the past is at points we do need to go stronger in the direction of actively seeking out women for roles and people of colour for roles. And the reason for that, the example I came up with is, and bear with me on this, as a kid, you're 8 or 9 and you've started a gang with your mates and you've got a gang of 20. And when you start, it's all boys because girls smell and girls are rubbish, but it's all boys. And then you get a bit older, and it's a one-in-one-out policy. It's always 20 of you. But you know, one of the lads moves away or goes to a different school. And you've got a mate who's a girl who's actually all right. So now there's a girl in the group. And it's 19 boys and one girl. And she's one of the guys. It's all right. She's good. Girls aren't that bad. And then actually her younger sister's all right as well and kind of has to come along. So as one of the other lads leaves, it's now 18 and 2. So it's still heavily in favour of male. And this goes on and goes on. And maybe you get to the point of, or let's leave it at 18-2 for this example now. You get into your teens and suddenly you're like, girls are all right. I kind of like girls. They're kind of cool. They've got some good ideas that are outside of my ideas. We'd like to level out the gang a bit, not for equality purposes, but just because it's good to have these other opinions and voices. And around that time, you know, let's say 6 of your mates are going off to a different uni. They're all going together up to Glasgow uni. So you've got 6 spaces, right? And the best way to get balance probably isn't to replace it like for like 6 males for 6 other males. And you know what? The best way probably isn't to go 50-50 of equal representation, 6 males and 6 females. The better way probably to go, arguably, is to go for 6 females. And then your group is 12 males, 8 girls. It's still not equal yet, but it's a far better mix. You're getting all these different perspectives and ideas. You're getting to hang out with girls, which is pretty cool now. And that's a better solution to a better and quicker solution, rather than saying, well, we've got gaps. We're not all males anymore. We're into equality. So we're going to have 3 males and 3 females. No, the better way is to replace at that point is to push, to surge towards getting closer to that equality by weighting it slightly. And, you know, in this situation, they're good girls. They're a good bunch of girls. They're all right. So, yeah, I think that's kind of the example that I often struggle to articulate on the fly. And I was thinking of that earlier, and I thought that's a good way of explaining it. So that's why I think, it's sometimes okay to wait things. I'm not saying that someone who's brilliant for the job should get overlooked for someone who's shit for the job just because of their colour or gender. But if 2 people are equal, then I'm up for kind of waiting in the direction that is less represented to kind of gradually start to level things out and to speed up the leveling out of these things. Anyway, this isn't just the Scroobius Pip podcast. I started to make that point in the podcast and I think I interrupted myself. So anyone who's a regular listener and occasionally gets annoyed that when I'm excited in a conversation, I sometimes interrupt people because I'm excited. I do it to myself as well. I genuinely think it's partly down to my stutter. I think because I'd struggle with some words and things like that, I do genuinely just get so excited to get things out that I'll blurt out and sometimes end up interrupting, which is rude. And I'm trying to correct that as best I can. I'm sorry, guys. Anyway, listen to this. I'll be back at the end with a bit of information on a stat that I started to drop and didn't have the numbers on, but I've got more information on now. So this is episode 213 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Kate Nash. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction.
saying let's do this for a while.
Fracturally ages. I'm joined today by Kate Nash. How are you?
I'm good.
We were just saying how long it's been. I was waiting in it, it's probably been 7 or 8 years.
I think so too.
Genuinely, and that seems like loads.
It's loads. But we're adult now. It has been 7 or 8 years since I've seen many people, which is insane.
It just happens. And we are, everyone's kind of, it's beautiful because, I mean, obviously we're going to talk a lot about Glow.
Yeah.
And then we'll rewind back to having just a bit of a reminisce. But it's mad that everyone in that kind of group, I've had Dockers on and I hadn't seen her in a few years. And Gemma I've seen a few times. But everyone seems to have just grown and evolved in so many different ways. And it's so nice to see. Because
really
we always kind of felt at the time there wasn't any logic to the grouping of people that there were.
So
there were you, me and Dan, or me and my pianist the first time I played with you, and Dockers and the Peggy Sue girls and Adele and all of this kind of thing, and Jack Pignatti and all this. And
I know.
It's not like everyone was making the same music or
anything.
It was just
something
there that everyone was motivated.
Such an interesting scene, because you're right. I've never thought about it like that, but I feel like I thought about this kind of recently, just because I get asked about like what I think of the music industry now.
Yeah.
And like listening to the radio, I've checked with myself so many times. I'm like, are you just turning into Grandpa Simpson? I'm like, back in my day, you could tell the difference between the songs.
Like,
I really feel like there's a lack of personality in the mainstream pop that I'm hearing anyway when I listen to the radio. And I've been in those we're jumping straight in here, but I've been in those rooms with producers and songwriters and tried to write for other people. And I have written for some people behind the scenes, it really is as sort of sad as it sounds, you know, trying to replicate songs that have been number one. And one minute you're writing it for this person and the next week it's like, oh, it's perfect for this person. And so you can kind of see that these songs do get passed around.
Yeah.
And so they don't necessarily have this personality. And I feel like we just had this beautiful moment, like you said, that where it wasn't even about a genre or specifically what someone was doing. It was just everyone had such a voice and everyone had such a personality, and you could hear it and you'd know exactly who that was, or see it and know exactly who that was. And that's a beautiful thing that I think is lacking in somewhat from today's artists. And I think some of the artists are trapped in that because it's like the system at the moment. But
it's kind of seen as the only way to succeed. And I think you're completely right. And I think it was, although there was a lot of great things done by people in the music industry and outside, and we'll talk later on about major label versus the DIY then versus DIY now, there's huge differences. But
definitely
all of that was happening, I feel, in spite of the music industry.
Yeah.
Because it was a time where the music industry, in my mind, was probably looking at someone like you or Peggy Sue or any of them and going, oh, we need a new Lily Allen. And that was the thing that's being bandied about a lot. But what they weren't realising was that was a time where, Lily, but also the Streets and the Arctic Monkeys and all that were all bringing storytelling and witty lyricism into music. So you were, that might have been their kind of idea of who they were getting with Kate Nash, but you were then allowed to go, right, well, actually, and again, I came up on the spoken word scene, so I saw people like John Cooper Clarke and you guys and all this kind of thing. So it was that thing of going, right, I'm speaking or rapping, but the music is different, but there's still that desire to tell stories, to paint pictures, to not just be, how the music industry goes, which is bizarre, is I go, well, this worked. And the reason Lily Allen worked at that point was because there hadn't been anyone like her in a while. So you shouldn't then pick or be looking for people like her.
And that's what they
do. The mistake that they make. That's the weirdness of the music industry. But it felt like everyone got to push through that in spite of it and go, all right, well, if that's what you think you're getting, then you can think that all along, but here's what I am and here's what I'm going to do. So how was that for you? In fact, let's get back to that all at the end, because I want to talk about Glow, because that's what you're doing at the moment and what you're here promoting. You have been doing the BBC this morning and all over the place. How's it been kind of, as the British character in it, you kind of take on the weight of a lot of the British promo, right? Is that kind of the case, that you're then kind of like, right, we'll get Kate to do
Yeah.
All of that side of the pond. How's that? Because that must be an exciting thing.
It's great. It's great. I love it. Last year I did it with Alison Brie and Betty Gilpin, which was so fun. Mark was actually here as well. Mark Marin was around, and we sort of did, like, we shared things together. But this year, I think, I'm not sure, they've sent people over to different areas. I know some of the girls are in New York right now, and everyone's been all over the place. So quite happy to do the London.
Champion.
Yeah, do the London scene. Know it well. Yeah. And yeah, it's just really cool to be doing a second season. I absolutely love being part of this show. It's a complete, like, dream come true, honestly.
It must have felt like amazing timing when this show came up. And it's something I feel is huge in acting. And I started to move over into acting a couple of years ago. And the beauty of it is, if you've got other things to keep you busy, then you can have the resolve to wait for the right thing to come along rather than just something. And Glow, to me, felt exactly that.
That's
because
true. Yeah, yeah,
musically,
yeah.
And we'll get to, we are going to go back to music. Musically, you'd very much evolved with the girl gang thing and a very empowering and political and outspoken approach. And this came along, and it's about strong, empowering women.
Yeah.
But all the way through, like, directing episodes and producing and all sorts, all along the production, it's not just Hollywood going, well, feminism is quite popular. Men in suits going, let's make a feminist thing. Because it doesn't have that feel either. It's quite beautiful that there's people in the group of girls who shout from different voices of feminism, which
Definitely.
Is a key thing as well.
Yeah, intersectional. Yeah, it has to be.
It's so easy to think of, I don't like feminism because of this. It's like, well, that's one person's view of feminism, another person's view, and the easiest one, and it comes up in Glow, is some women feel the objectification of women is male and damages women, and others feel that a woman's right and ability to be a sexual being or be whoever they want to be is their right and is empowering.
Yeah,
and
it's
great that stuff like that can come up in a show about wrestling,
essentially. Totally.
So how was it when that kind of came along and you were looking at it and going, right, is this something I'm going to be?
Yeah, I mean, I heard the cut. I did a show with Genji that was directed by Gus Van Sant. Eddie Izzard starred in it. It was a pilot that we shot for a month near Salem. About the witch trials, and it was so cool, but it didn't get picked up. We shot for about a month, and everything seemed really positive, and then I was quite heartbroken when it didn't get picked up. But because of that, you know, I'd met Genji, and I met the casting director, Jen Houston, who was then casting for Genji's new show, Glow, and I heard about it. I think I heard three or four words. I literally had, like, glow, wrestling, spandex, glitter, women, and I was like, oh my God, I want to do this so much. I was like, oh God. And I just worked really hard on the audition. I took it so seriously. And I was just like, you know, there's a few things. I feel like I'm pretty go with the flow. And I feel, you know, it's different when you're sort of steering a ship a little bit. There's not, like, things. I don't feel like in music there's things where I'm like, I need this and I want this.
Yeah.
I don't know. My career's been, I suppose maybe because I exploded, like, very young and really quickly. I was like, whoa, what is this? And this feels weird. And then I was like, okay, I need to navigate this so that I can have a career, but, like, I want to be a comfortable human being, and fame isn't, I don't know. There was lots of things where, and I've been doing it for 10 years, so I've been able to explore so many things.
Yeah, of course.
But, like, with this is one of the first things where I ever was like, I just was like, this is mine. This is mine. Yeah. And I, like, want this, and I will do anything to get it, kind of thing, you know. Not anything, but nothing evil. Yeah. But I just felt so strongly about it, and so I worked really hard on the audition and got the part. And I was just like, it just felt so right.
Yeah.
It felt so right, and like you said, it weirdly just slotted into my life. Of like, you know,
it seemed just it seemed like a perfect fit.
I
remember
a perfect fit, weirdly.
When it was coming out, because there's always nerves when it's anything that anyone you know is involved in, because if it's shit, that's really awkward, and you hate that. And also, I'm genuinely a big wrestling fan, and wrestling fans are really hard to please.
Oh, my God, Sam Duckworth.
Yeah.
On my...
Of course.
When I first told Sam.
Yeah.
I was like, so I've got this audition. It's like kind of a secret, but it's about this show Glow. And he was like, Kate, what are you doing with Glow? Wait a minute, a minute. And he suddenly was just like, you need to take this seriously. I was like, Sam, don't ever go at me. Like, I am taking it seriously. Yeah. He's like, no. And then he like sent me like Dropbox files of like interviews and research. And I was just like, oh my God, these wrestling fans are hardcore.
They really are. And that's what I think. I did a film with a Fox this year called Walk Like a Panther. And it's about wrestling.
Cool.
And it was one of them where I feel it didn't totally connect with the wrestling fans. That's not anything to do with the quality of the film or anything like that. It's just wrestling fans are so specific.
They
and
are.
You had even more pressure of it being a real thing. Glow was a TV show.
Totally.
It was a thing that happened. You're delivering history and dramatising it.
Yeah.
And it just seemed to work so well. The wrestling fans seemed to be into it.
Yeah.
You didn't have to be a wrestling fan to be into it. You didn't have to be. And again, I think the fear of the more ignorant men at the moment is the fear that we're going to get all this woman power stuff and men, it's not for men, it's all for women. That's not the case. The more, again, I was discussing this recently with a mate saying that it's weird that I'm sitting here now kind of looking at acting projects and most of the projects I'm most excited about need to be black or need to be female.
Yeah.
And it's mildly frustrating, but I'm sitting there aware that that's been the opposite for the whole history of TV and cinema. So you can't get mad at that. It's a positive thing. It's like right now, it's just all it's doing is levelling out.
Right, the personal versus the political.
Yeah,
and that's
completely.
Like, you know, I feel that so much with the diversity within my show.
Yeah.
And I'm like, these women are like my sisters, you know what I mean? I care about them so much. And I also want to make sure that they're being elevated from this show, like, and as the show continues to grow, that they get more and more elevated. And like, I feel part of history doing this. I don't know. That feels more important to me than like how many lines I'm getting or what my, I just like feel this role. This is so special because we are a real team.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that we nailed, you know, we managed to, I won't say nailed, that sounds too cocky or something, but the fact that we managed to make wrestling fans happy and wrestlers happy.
Yeah.
It has to be because we had Chavo Guerrero involved in the project. You know, he taught us about wrestling and we didn't know about it, you know. I mean, I did research on my own, but it was through Chavo that I learned to respect the culture. I learned like his family, like it's in his blood, you know. And
100%.
I just respect the wrestling culture and I'm amazed by it. And also Kia, having Kia on the show. Like we had these two like iconic wrestlers involved in the show. And also the creators made real efforts to, this wasn't a show about like making fun of wrestling or not taking it seriously. It's like definitely a group of misfits who has found themselves in a position they didn't expect to be in, which is very meta because it's kind of the same for us.
I was going to say it's meta throughout as well. And I've watched the first half of the second series now. And the first series is a group of misfits trying to make this TV show work. And the second series is, oh, the TV show's worked. Now we've got to deliver on
it. Now don't let it fall apart.
Exactly, which is, it's beautiful because it's what's happening for all of you as well. So,
it makes it
all the more engaging to watch, I guess, because you can feel that it is a group of girls that at the start didn't all know each other that well and are from different backgrounds, different experiences. And then as it goes on, you do all become this team. So
it's funny what you said earlier about, you know, like men worrying about women taking all the space.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of something that women have been taught from day one, that 100%. Other women will take their space.
Yeah.
And so it's a total myth. I mean, it's just a fear, I guess. It's something that people like to incite fear in people. But, you know, we've had to like carve out the space to not fight each other and go, and I don't mean specifically in Glow because I feel like, I just mean like in general, the past however many years this has been building up to, women have had to go, do you know what? I'm going to support other women. Like, I'm not being competitive against them because there's loads of room in this world and there's just like so much out there now more than ever, it feels
And there was previously a culture of bitchiness and competitiveness, as you say, between women that wasn't necessarily as there between men.
Yes.
Because they were kind of probably all already getting a seat at the table.
Exactly.
As such. If the women feel like they're fighting over the one or two seats.
Exactly. And there's a really big table. Yeah. Listen, there's a huge table. And the more diverse it is, the better for the world it is.
Yeah.
You know,
In fact, the table, the best stuff's going on in the kitchen anyway.
Exactly. So it's true. Kind of,
it is that weird competitivism to get somewhere that is fictional, that's a myth.
Right, exactly. I think, and that's what's exciting about TV right now, is because it just feels like there's so much being made and created, and that there's just like worlds and worlds out there for people to explore. I mean, it's a difficult world to get into, but I've sort of chipped away at it for a while, and, you know, it's always been something I've wanted to do, never known if it's actually going to come to fruition.
Yeah.
So now, like you said before, it kind of feels like, okay, like this was supposed to be the role I was going to get. Yeah. And I wasn't supposed to get the other things. Yeah. And this is me, and this is where I'm supposed to be. And yeah, I'm just so happy and grateful to be part of such an amazing show of amazing women.
It's such a great example as well for people who are going through that struggle of chasing things, that knowing that the right thing will come along eventually. I had an audition recently for Good Omens, which is Neil Gaiman, who's amazing.
Mm.
And I didn't get it, and he gave me some feedback.
Yeah.
And I was saying, like, my genuine outlook then, and it's, again, that this outlook is enforced by seeing the perfect role come for you in this and things like that, was, I was like, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, but I'm now excited because it's Neil Gaiman. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
There's going to be a second season.
Yeah.
Imagine how much better I'll be in a year or two.
Yeah,
when
that
opportunity comes around again, I will have had more time to find the right thing. And it feels like this is that role. It wasn't... There's no looking out of place on screen. There's no looking as if you're not meant to be there. It feels like that's exactly... You know, what was meant for you. But again, it's perfect. It's all meta because it is. It's the Brit abroad.
Yeah.
It's the Brit in with all the LA girls not really knowing and feeling, you know, a deer in headlights. So, So how has it been getting in with all the different girls and working together and making that?
Oh, God, it's just like the coolest thing. I mean, everybody's so funny.
Yeah.
And I go to work every day when we're on set and we just laugh so much.
Yeah.
And it's like bit after bit after bit after bit after bit, and they fire off of each other. And you know, when we're not like actually on set and shooting, it's just like comedy routine. There's like so much happening.
Yeah.
And even like in between on set, you know, our energy levels are just kept up by each other, just messing around. And everyone's so perfect. Such a good improviser. Yeah.
It's perfect because of how long and drawn out those days can be.
I know you're there on like 16-hour day.
It's just messing about.
Exactly. It's just like the best environment. I feel so grateful. And then I get to watch them work, and they're just so talented. And I feel like I'm around all these geniuses, and I get to be like, oh, my God, like, look at her and look at her. And the camaraderie and, you know, how, like, I did this move. I did, like, my biggest wrestling move.
Yeah.
And I was really nervous about it. Me and Brittany Young had this, like, big move. And we did it. And I've got footage. I can show you the footage.
I want to see what it is.
Yeah.
I want to see if I can identify it.
Well,
a wrestling nerd.
Thank you. And I, like, as soon as I hit the mat.
Yeah.
I, like, nailed the move. And all the girls, like, started running towards me, and in wrestling, you know, there's a culture of saying like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And like everyone was on the side of the ring, and everyone ran into the ring, and they're all just like, we're all just like hugging and screaming, and all the girls are going, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit. And
amazing.
Like, it was just like so amazing to like all the creators and everyone, the directors, and everyone's just looking at us like, these girls are, this is like a different kind of project because we're just so in it and supportive of each other.
Yeah.
And if you do a scene and the girls aren't there, it's weird.
Yeah.
I don't know how I did, because there's not like a bunch of girls to be
it's
like,
not to go, that was great.
This that was great. This or this, because we give each other so much feedback and like.
It sounds like a perfect atmosphere.
God, I love
that
it.
Everyone is in that same a position. I remember when I was doing Taboo on the BBC, and I'm getting to work with Tom Hardy and Stephen Graham and these amazing people, but they were all confused by the fact that I'd just be there watching, even if I didn't have a scene. Just because, again, it was that excitement of I wanted to be there and I wanted
and
to learn because
you
I've
learn.
Not... Exactly, I've not done all the drama school and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So it was that excitement, and it ended up going down well. But I can also see how that could go down badly if they're like, if they're all professionals,
and they want,
and there's this one that's like, Mr. Walden, look at that, this is exciting. It's
he's
like,
so handsome.
Can you just calm down, please. We're trying to make things work, but it feels great that you've got a whole team who are all like that. Who are like, let's all be here and let's make this scene work and be excited if they nail it, not just okay, we got that. On to the next scene. It's you got that. I've been working a weeks on that move and I didn't die. It shouldn't just be, we've got that, let's move on to the next
so
scene.
So true. It's so cool. So, it's so cool to be around it.
So how was it, or how has it been? Because I think it must be different when you're doing press over here compared to in the US. Because in the US, obviously you toured over there a lot, but you weren't as known a name as over here. Yeah. Therefore, in the US, they're probably taking you just as an actor. At face value, whereas over here, I'd imagine you get an awful lot of. So, how's it transitioning from music into acting? Which, knowing you from back in the day, I seem to remember that you were more acting on the Brit School type thing, anyway, or more in the drama direction, anyway, and music almost not pulled you away from that, but that started to go amazingly. So, it's like, all right, I'm a musician then.
Yeah.
I was trying to be an actor, but I've just been told I'm a musician, so now I'll go and do that.
Well, it's been a weird blend for me because I started playing piano at 7 years old and writing songs as a kid. And I just loved songwriting. It just was so fun to me and felt so good. And I didn't even realise the sort of emotional soul therapeutic connection I had with it. But I just did it because it felt good.
Yeah.
And that's like really pure, you know. Like that's why we start these things. It just feels good. So we're like, let's do that. And then I was started acting classes at 14 and I went to the Brit School for an opening night. I found it online and I was like, I'm going to go to this school. And it's in Croydon. And I was from Harrow and my mum and dad were like, no, you're not. But they were like, well, they're very supportive parents. So they were like, we'll go to the opening night with you and check it out. But my mum and dad said, they were like, you know, she's not going to go to Croydon every day for school. It's ridiculous. It's so far. And then we went to this open evening and it was just like, I was like, I'm going here.
This is it.
It was amazing. And my mum and dad were really impressed by it as well. And just all the students were so friendly and that teacher seemed amazing. And like the work that they were doing and they got behind me on it and they were like, okay, let's do this. And I'd gone to see the music and theatre departments and I just had this gut feeling. I was like, I want to do theatre. I just feel like that's where I'm supposed to be, which felt a little out of the blue then because I was much more like, you know, doing grades, music, studying music at school, performing compositions in school concerts and stuff. But I just wanted to pursue the acting. I'm so glad I did because I feel like that shaped the songwriter that I am.
Yeah,
the theatrical background, like you're saying, the storytelling.
Yeah.
It made me comfortable with myself. It put me in touch with myself in a different way. It was so creative and so raw and naked. You know, theatre is a very naked thing to do.
Yeah, completely.
And that just gave me what I needed to then write the songs and that I write now. And but then, you know, as you said, I was like, okay, so I'm going to be an actor. I was very set on this path. I'm going to drama school. So my friends were going to drama school. I wanted to had universities as backups. And I just got rejected from everything, even my safety university, you know, like
damn.
I was working in Nando's. And I think, you know, the universe just decides sometimes when you're not going to do something because that would have maybe sent me on a wrong path. And, and so I broke my foot, fell down the stairs, broke my foot, got my last rejection letter, worked in Nando's. And I was thinking, this isn't cool. This isn't exactly what I planned. And all my friends are like drama school, university or whatever they're doing. And I'm like serving chicken. And I just wanted to grab my life back.
Yeah.
You know, which sounds dramatic, but I was a teenager, so it was dramatic,
of course,
you know.
And it needs to be.
And I actually had like a crazy, I sort of get my timeline a bit blurred because I had a heart condition and I had this heart surgery as well around that time, which was a big risk to my life and this crazy laser surgery. And,
oh, wow.
And that I skipped over for a few years because it was so just normal and quite private for me. But I think that was a big effect on why everything was quite like intense and why I didn't waste time because I'd already
massive
had
motivation, right? To have that at a young age, go,
exactly.
Oh, this could all be over tomorrow, by the way.
Yeah.
You get told that all the time, but just to have it really Literally, I was going to say drilled into you, but lasered into you.
Lasered off you.
Literally, this could end any second, make you go, all right, well, let's get on with this.
I was like, yeah, exactly. And I look back now and I'm like, of course that affected me. But in a way, I was a bit desensitized to it. But so that happened. And then I also spent a summer at Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
And I mean, I recommend that for any...
People moan at me for going on about it so much on the podcast. Like, I've only been two or three times, but it's the most motivational place in the world.
It's so motivating, and it's just so free, and there's so much going on. You just, like, get inspired by unexpected things.
The only problem I have with it is how inspirational it is at times. So I'll be watching a show, and if something twigs an idea 10 minutes in, I'm thinking off on all these tangents.
I need to get me out of here.
I want to enjoy the art that's here, but it's such an inspirational,
it's really
place.
Inspiring. So that all happened around the same time. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to start a MySpace account whilst I've got this broken foot. I'm going to record these songs. My mum and dad bought me my first electric guitar. I got a white one because Jimi Hendrix had a white guitar. And I was like, it was like 60 quid from like Mill Hill Music rehearsal space. And I was going to write songs and upload them as soon as my foot was healed. My deal was like, I'm going to make my MySpace live and book my first gig when my foot is healed. And so that was my time limit.
Yeah.
And so I think that kind of just like was the, you know, that's what I needed to like make it happen.
It's got the pressure there. I'll do it at some point. It's like, here's when it's happening.
I could have put that off for years, you know.
Or even the restriction of, I can't do it now.
Yeah.
That's got to be a massive motivator. Because if it was a case of, I'll book a gig tomorrow, you might have done that gig, it's not gone well.
Exactly.
Oh, this isn't for me. Whereas, I can't do it now, I'm going to get really ready.
Yeah.
So when I can do it,
yeah.
You did seem to then appear as a finished a product.
Yeah.
Sound, songs, a look, all this kind of thing all at once. But I guess that's because you'd been sitting there with your foot up. Just kind of going, I'm going to build all this.
It was just really natural. Like, I just wrote these songs literally in, you know, my mum and dad's living room, and I was wearing vintage dresses because who wasn't in 2006 and 7? I was like, oh, wow, I don't have to wear, like, the jeans that don't fit me in River Island and make me feel bad. And, like, I can just, like, wear a different style. And, like, I was at the Brit School. Everyone's, like, artsy and interesting. And we were just, like, running around London being mischievous. And Gemma was living on Brick Lane. And, you know, like, I had such good friends. Like, me, Gemma and Laura were running around London just doing our own thing and meeting all these characters that we end up
and doing everything as well. Again, I think that's the big motivation, is if you've got friends who aren't going, you probably can't do that. Mm-hmm. If you've got friends who are going, all right, let's try that.
Yeah.
It's that.
And it's fun to do it together.
It's that exciting youth, of like, let's just do it. Let's put on a gig.
Oh my God, we put on this terrible gig in South London with this guy who like found the three of us, interviewed us, wanted to put us on for this night, which was in this... I can't remember what venue it was. It was like a big venue and no one came.
Yeah.
And he was a scammer and he tried to not pay us. And then he was trying to kick me off stage whilst I was playing, and I was like playing dickhead. And we all just like had like a fight afterwards in the streets of Brixton. And it was, you know, it was just really, it was just like fun London youth, like nightlife experience whilst we were all trying to do our own. Me and Gemma like snuck into Tea in the Park. We got the mega bus up there for £1.
Amazing.
Like, she brought the worst recorder ever. And I brought a crap digital camera. And that was like, we were being pressed backstage somehow. And, you know, she's trying to sneak interviews with people. She's totally scamming her way in there.
Because when Gemma, I said to her, she was the one that for years, I didn't actually know what she did. I knew she did stuff, but she was doing the fashion, she was doing the art direction, she was doing this.
I was a major blagger.
I know that Dockers was doing poetry and stuff like that and drawing, and you were singing and this, but I was like, I know Gemma, I don't know what she's here though. But that
she
was,
did always want to do radio. She was always doing little bits of radio, but it was like fitting in. Gemma was like, I'm going to find like whatever I can get into that keep kind of the same
and
thing.
And try them all out.
Try them all
kind
out,
the
float
key.
Along until she like got her, you know, moment in radio, and then just like has flourished since then.
I remember, today I'll get a lot of messages and emails or whatever on social media saying, how do I start a poetry night, or how do I get into the music scene or whatever else? And that was the question that wasn't being asked by that crowd then.
Yeah.
Just do it. You weren't saying
just
how.
Just do
going,
it.
Let's try. Well, I found out you can't do it that way because that night was awful.
So
let's try it this way. Rather than trying to get
just
instruction manual.
And I think going deep end and going the cold water and like, don't know what you're doing. When I did my first gig, I didn't know how to plug in my keyboard.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah. I mean, I sort of did plug it in. But I didn't like know what I was doing, you know. I was nervous about all those things. And
it's the illusion that everyone knows what they're doing.
And you learn as you go.
If you've seen Kate Nash on MySpace, so she's got a lot of listeners, you assume she knows.
Right.
She's got it all figured out. It's like,
oh my God, I remember we went to Electric Gardens Festival. It was so funny. We drove up in Claire's Renault Clio, my sister's Renault Clio. We all crammed all this gear. Jay, Helen, Claire, a keyboard, a drum kit. But I don't know how we did that. Stayed at my nan's house, got there. You know, I didn't know what a tech spec was. What's a stage plan? I don't know what that is. Had no idea what we're doing. The guy, because I was so honest, so just kind of like, I really don't know what I'm doing. Like, I need help. He took a liking to that because he said loads of people just act like they know what they're doing and they don't. So he kind of preferred that we were just like, all right, he's like, I like you guys, I'm going to help you out. And yeah, you learn as you go along. And it's so fun to do that. Do you know what the other thing I've just realized is? MySpace was like the only, I think MySpace was one of the most incredible things that's happened ever.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, it really was like, in my lifetime anyway, the only free reign world that has existed where it wasn't run by advertisers, it wasn't run by labels, it was run by kids. Mm-hmm. That is, I mean, Tom from MySpace started it.
Yeah.
But who had the power on MySpace? Kids.
Yeah.
And I think about that now and I'm like, of course that's why it died. They took that down because...
And it was pre the kind of cynicism that comes with a lot of social media now. Yeah. I genuinely felt MySpace seemed to be, everyone was just excited about shit.
And you would just go on someone's page and you'd find, you know, oh, they've got Scroobius Pip, what's this? I'm going to click on that.
Yeah.
Scroobius Pip, oh, what's who's his top eight? Like, I'm going to check this out. Okay, I like this artist. And you discover so much music and no one had control over it.
No,
and like, they don't, you know, that's why, like, it doesn't exist anymore because advertisers and money and profit and all that, like, wants to have control over everything because... God forbid, like, kids are actually making decisions for themselves. Like, you know, it was like such an exciting time to be around because it just was a blip. And it meant so many careers happened because of that amazing blip.
Completely. I remember the first time I played with you, it was supporting you. I'd been offered, I could either support Just Jack, who was in the charts
Just
at the
Jack,
time.
Oh, yeah, Just Jack,
or Kate Nash. And I'd heard of you and I just went on MySpace. Yeah. And I think Shit Song and Birds, I think. Well, the two I heard, I was like, I like them.
Cool.
We'll take that gig. And at that point, it was similar. I had four or five songs, and that was it. And the pianist I was working with, I was like, I was working on a new track, and we decided it'd either get us kicked out or go down well. And I got him to play Shit Song, and I did the Beat Them Up.
I remember this.
At the time, it didn't have a beat at all, so it's the first time it ever got from. And I was like, we'll end on it. And either people will like it or people will be like, fuck you prick. And it went down well.
Yeah.
And we ended up, I realised as well the other day, the first video I ever uploaded to YouTube was a phone video of your gig at the Old Blue Last, where you got me up to do
my
lyrics over Shit Song. And we did it back, like, we'd never practice it. The only other time I've done that since is with Amanda Palmer. So it's always good, powerful.
That's so cool.
Pianists.
You know? I love that.
But yeah, I'd completely forgotten. And the quality is appalling. But yeah, it was just out of the blue.
Like,
I was just there.
What phone was that?
Yeah, it was like a proper Nokia 3210 all day long.
I miss the days.
It was so simple, wasn't it?
So fun. It was so fun.
So let's let's bring a big shadow over that then. How was it when it developed and you kind of, you blew up? Because I remember...
It is, do you know what though? It's really nice to talk about this and like just talking about those days. I forget how fun that was.
Yeah.
I really do.
It's amazing fun. Because the problem with the music industry is as soon as you start to get into it, you start to lose the perspective.
They crush
the
your soul.
You wanted to get into it. Yeah, completely. I remember talking to you, or you, Adele and Jack were three people... Each that when your albums came out, I kind of just made the point of just saying, how fucking great is it that you've got an album out? Because all of you before your albums come out have blown up. Therefore, you're now in the well of where is it in the charts? Is it higher than that person? Is it lower than that person? Is this single higher than that? And not actually going, I've got a CD in HMV.
Yeah.
Like, I can go in and buy that and it's mine. And that gets lost so quickly. And it's easy to lump that on major labels. I don't think it's that. It's major labels, it's indie labels, it's the industry in general. So
the pressure.
So how was that? Because it must have been hard. Because I remember seeing... I remember, you don't even know this, but I argued with a one of your label people once.
Did you?
Because we did a gig with you at Brixton. I think it was an XFM thing. And they, you'd
tell
smashed
me.
It. Like you were headlining it, I think. And but all the dressing rooms are shared. And they were kind of having a go at you at the end because you, or Jay probably, had started the wrong version of the current single, like a remix version or something like that. And they were giving you a bollock in it. And you ended up just running off into the crowd. And I kind of said to him at the time, I was like,
God, I don't even remember this.
It was amazing. I remember it clearly because it was like just looking at them and going, you're talking to an 18 or 19-year-old girl who's just been number one or number two or whatever in the charts. And you're telling them, like, you shouldn't, if you're an 18-year-old and you've had a number one, you shouldn't be able to be told off for anything for like a year. That should be a rule. You should be able to go, look, all right, you've written that yourself, you've done that yourself. Yeah. But it's the pressure of...
your mum should be able to tell you off, but
yeah,
you, these,
obviously,
like,
your parents
people
and your
that
mates.
Are coming in and getting money off you.
Exactly. But yeah. Again, that's the weird thing, and that's the thing I want to kind of talk about, is
Let's
the weirdness of the music industry is, the from what I've seen, because I saw similar with a Paloma Faith at points, just seeing her label just getting angry over the smallest things, and they're all lovely. I'm not having a go at anyone, but it's that problem of, if you sign an indie deal, you've got far less marketing, you've got far less push, but you've got more control and less pressure. If you sign a major label deal, they've given you a fuckload of money.
Yeah.
So whilst it is shit that they're feeling they can have a say, they've kind of paid for that right as well.
Yeah,
so it's
kind of
not a deal with the devil, but there's ups and downs on it.
Yeah.
I can see where annoyance, the evils of major labels, but I can also see it's like, well, if they've gone, here's however many thousands of pounds, they've kind of got some right to have some kind of say, right? They've kind of bought that right in a way.
Yeah.
Do you feel that, or do you feel that's...
What do I feel about that? I feel like artists are the thing that they're selling. They're the cool thing.
Yeah.
They're making... And I'm not even talking about myself. I'm not like, I'm the cool thing. I'm actually looking at... Because my perspective has all been totally affected. I've through the eye of the needle the last few years on that and come out the other side, thank God. And many people don't. And I think it's a very manipulative industry.
100%.
I think it's killed many artists.
Yeah.
So I don't have a lot of sympathy for them.
Yeah,
and
no, I get
that. I feel like it's this weird thing where they have also got to have a responsibility for the life and mental health of their artist. And they don't
hugely.
Take that responsibility.
And
they don't.
That's. I mean, let's talk about that more because that's a huge thing.
You're giving me a load of money and I'm going to work for you. But I'm working for you to sell myself.
Yeah.
And you don't give a fuck about me, but you're going to profit off me.
Yeah. Completely.
And then you're going to drop me and use that money to, like, work somebody else. Like, whatever, like,
completely.
Go home, get another job, get a new
car. Should
be
the investment in belief in the artist, not in control in the artist, right?
Exactly.
Saying, here's the money, we believe in you, let's make this big. Not, here's the money, we're going to change it.
Where's the bigger picture?
Yeah.
You know, let artists develop, let them change, let them experiment, let them have a career. You know, I think that... If I was working with a younger artist now and I was coming from a different viewpoint of, like, the business side, I feel like I have a lot of young artists around me who, like, ask me for support and help and that are in my life and have a relationship with. And I'm like, first and foremost, I care about them emotionally because I know that there's not many people around them that probably do.
Yeah.
But if I feel like I was coming at it, I'd be like, look, you know, if you look, it seems so weird. It's like if someone's grabbing onto you, like if I'm holding your hand like this, you're like, you want to pull away and you're like, get off me. If I don't do that, you're not running away from me.
Yeah, yeah.
So why isn't there more of a, like, give and take of, like, okay, I mean, life's just sped up to such a, like, a pace that we can't keep up with. We cannot keep up with it.
Particularly in the industry as well, if you're looking at, you're chasing chart position after chart position. And then,
you know, why don't you let someone do something weird for a while?
Yeah.
Do a record that's not going to be in the charts. You know what?
Exactly.
This is going to be good for you. Get out there, tour it. Just work on the relationship with the fans. If your fans love you, they're probably, you know, if it's good songs, even if it's not commercial, let's, like, do that for a while.
Yeah.
And then maybe come back and we'll do, or maybe we'll do, you know, what? I just, like, don't know why they work on compromise. Like,
completely.
But they don't treat you like an adult. So it's hard to react as one. That's why I did find myself like running off sometimes, yeah. And having not knowing what to do and having these breakdowns.
And you shouldn't be put in that kind of,
you're so young,
pressure and situation. I always remember
it's just like weird.
Sage Francis talking about. I was a big fan of his before I started music, and he announced he was taking a couple of years off, and I was gutted. And then I saw the reason was he had to go and live a bit, yeah, to have more to write about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I loved that. I was like, yeah, right, so you know that you could get, yeah, record sales and tour money, yeah, if you release something now, but you need to go away and live.
But people now feel so much pressure, they have to just constantly release.
Yeah.
And so that's why there's like rooms full of songwriters writing for them, because you can't even like do that anymore for yourself.
No. No.
But I have to say, like, the main thing that's been helpful for me is if you can see that, and this applies to, I think, everybody now, because we all have this, AI in our, yeah, hands, we all have a phone, we all have Instagram, most of us have Twitter, we all have, like, everyone can have a platform and can be, yeah, close to fame. And so what you have to understand is, like, fame is a bottomless pit and you'll never fill that cup.
Truly, yeah.
So you'll never be satisfied by that. You can always be more famous. You could always get more likes. You can always get more attention. Someone's going to be better than you, bigger than you, more famous than you, get more, you know, get whatever it is. Like, it's not going to, there's no full. You don't fill the cup and go, and I did it, I'm satisfied.
And the quicker you realise that, the better. I remember, yeah, seeing an interview with Matt Damon, and he was saying how he felt really grateful in the end that, yeah, he won an Oscar so early for Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
Because he went out and partied that night or whatever, and then he got home and he was literally, he put it on the side in the toilet and realised that nothing had changed.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it didn't,
yeah,
didn't mean anything. Yeah. So it then meant he could have a career where he's just enjoying it and chasing, yeah, the artistic,
yeah,
drives, yeah, rather than simply, yeah, oh, I want to get that award or this award, because
totally,
that's
these
what you're
targeted
towards.
Are they're so political anyway, but yeah, you know, I think that, and also this highlight, like you said, on diversity, it's like, who doesn't have a seat at the table, who, yeah, doesn't even get a look in,
yeah,
and that's, you know, that's why intersectional feminism is so important. It's not just about white women. It's not just about my right to be here. It's not. There's so many people that need to be at this table that are going through more than I can even know about, because it's not, yeah, my experience.
Completely.
So breaking all of this down and realizing what really matters is like, A, kept me sane, and B, given me so much perspective, made me so grateful for what I have, refreshed my career. I love what I do. I love playing shows. I love making music. I've gone through some very rough times. They've shaped me. And I'm here for a reason, and I have Glow for a reason. And it's all just given me, you know, I have such a beautiful family and friends and, yeah, animals. And I can appreciate those little things and put the time in my life to appreciate those, which when it's all a blur,
and taking that time has to be key, right?
It's like, whether you're forced to or you choose to, it so depends on, like, I don't know, you can lose, like you said, the not being able to go, that's so cool, I've got a CD,
yeah,
and now I've been doing this 10 years, and I'm like, I just went on tour in America. I've done that like so many times, and, yeah, I just like couldn't believe, it was so funny, I was in Denver and I'm looking out and I'm like, I just can't believe that. Like, I'm from Harrow. I'm watching people from Denver sing lyrics to my music. It's just nuts.
It's mad. Yeah.
And it is mad. And you should never lose that. That is just so exciting. It's like Christmas, you know, yeah, like, I can't believe this. I'm meeting people in Salt Lake City who have a relationship with me that I don't, yeah, know about,
amazing,
you know?
It?
And that is the beauty of music. And that, I think, is why we're searching for. For me, I'm searching for connectivity. I'm searching to connect with someone and have this feeling of relating to them and sharing, yeah, a feeling. I mean, I had this girl. I hope this isn't all over the place. So my coffee's kicked in and I'm like emotional. So it's
this
like,
is how my podcast works. I plan them out.
I hope
really
I'm making sense
clearly, and then I ignore my notes. As you've
great
seen, I've not looked at my notes once.
Yeah.
I ignore them, and we just go all over the great place. That's how it works.
There was this girl I met in Denver. I'll never forget her. She was standing at the front. I mean, Denver was one of my favorite shows ever. It was just, it wasn't even the most packed show or anything, or the loudest, but everybody there was such a Kate Nash fan.
Yeah,
I could tell they dressed for the show. They there was these two Asian women at the front who looked sort of angry and like they didn't want to be there. They were hunched over and I could tell they were just like, oh my God, they probably didn't like going to shows. But they had made their own T-shirts with my lyrics on. And
That's amazing, right?
Like, oh, you just put yourself through being out in this gig that you clearly don't want to be at just to like be here. That's amazing. Yeah. And then there was just all these characters dressed up in certain ways. And there was this one girl and she had an Alaska headband on. And I noticed her, she was just so cute. I have such like outsider special fans.
Yeah.
And we met in the car park after the show. And she was actually the first thing that Emma, my bassist, said when we got off stage was that girl was crying so much during The Nicest Thing. I actually wanted to run down and hug her.
Yeah.
She said it was a different kind of crying. And we met in the car park and she said, she told us that her and her sister were like massive fans of me and it was like part of their relationship and they'd always wanted to come and see me together. And her sister had died a couple of years ago and Nicest Thing was her favourite song. And she was from Alaska and her grandparents lived in Denver. So she drove to Denver to come to the show because she knew she had to be there for her sister. And I was like, that is why I'm doing this, you know? It's not any of the other stuff.
And you're getting to experience all of that because of being kind of aside from the industry a bit, if it feels like now, from doing the Kickstarter approach and things like that. Just wanted to touch again on, you were saying earlier about the pressures put on people in the music industry, but I think it is greater on women. And the fact is, you and me standing on the street, it's a well-known fact that the male suicide rate is far higher than female. It's two-thirds, I think. Yeah. I haven't got my exact stats. But within the music industry,
it's the biggest killer of men, isn't it?
It's the biggest killer of men, yeah. And
it's far more
prevalent in men. Yeah, it's more than road accidents, everything. But in the music industry, it flips. And the suicide rate of women is far higher than the suicide rate of men. And that was something I only learned recently from Eddie Temple Morris, who I've worked with at Calm for years and things like that. But do you think there is that extra pressure? Because women in the industry aren't only, particularly in your area of the industry, where you're not just the pop star, you're the writer and creator. So not only have you got the pressure of being a writer and a creator and a musician and playing your instrument, but you've also got to be sexy and you've also got to say the right things and appeal in all these ways that a lot of bands don't, or a lot of male-fronted bands don't particularly have to. There's not pressure on, just picking them out of my head, on Mumford & Sons to be sex symbols or anything else. No, not many people are going to say horrible or derogatory things about them, whereas any female vocalist, if she does a show and isn't looking to the standard that people would want, or, you know, in a pop world maybe more, then people comment online or on social media and say, you look shit, or whatever
I'm just laughing because I just feel like I'm just such a scruff as well. It's like so funny that I was put in that position and like I had no idea it was going to hit me, but it's just like, I think that's why people also liked me, because it was real. And I was like a teenage girl with acne and like you know, wearing what they were wearing and just kind of but anyway, the other
but
pressure,
did you feel that once you were in it, though, because you came in
oh my God, I was running away from paparazzi,
and then all of a sudden you were at the forefront of things. So there is that pressure. And even just personally, everyone likes, we shy away a lot these days, or we put any level of pride or anything like that down as arrogance or Kardashians or obsession or whatever else. But it's nice personally to feel nice as well.
Yeah.
And that, I'm not saying that has to be slim or pretty or anything else, but it's nice to feel nice within yourself. I feel better if I've got up and showered and got dressed and put on a nice shirt than if I'm sitting around in a T-shirt and feeling grotty and feeling rubbish. So how was all that to kind of come into it as the kind of the counterculture, the alternative to how women can be? Then having such pop success, you then kind of get some pressure. Oh, but you do need to fit into our mould as well.
Yeah. I felt very rebellious towards it. I'm the middle child. I'm a redhead. I'm very stubborn. I feel like I would be like, so I would rebel against that.
Yeah.
It was just natural for me to rebel against that. I was emotional about it. And it liked being bullied, you know. but I didn't succumb to it because I just kind of felt like I knew it was wrong and I was angry about it. And I wanted to be there for my fans that, like, you know, I just wanted to be there for the other, like, normal. I wanted to be normal. I just wanted to be like, I'm like everyone else. I'm not going to be this, like, perfect mold. And I don't think that, like, music has to be about that. And so I kind of rebelled intentionally against that, but it was like so natural. I didn't like plan it. I was just be like, on the day, I'd be like, ugh. I remember it would just come over me and I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. But, you know, we have to learn how to value ourselves and love ourselves. And sometimes that happens when you hit rock bottom and you go, why have I been doing what these patterns in my life? Like, why have I ended up in these relationships? Or, you know, where what I've been kind of fighting myself in certain ways, and I think that, like, I've had to look at myself and really realize how little I've valued myself. And I wonder, is that because I've been in abusive relationships? Is that because I've been bullied by the media? What would I be like without that? I don't know. But what would any of us be if we were just, like, growing up in, like, the woods and didn't know about media and didn't know about the pressure to look what beautiful or ugly was, you know? No one told us what those things were. Like, how would we all be different? I mean, we'll never know that. But I think I try to fight my urge to criticize myself every day. And I realize that that's in all of us. But yeah, I don't even know what the question necessarily was.
But we've gone off on a wonderful route. I mean, it's an interesting one because you're something I wanted to talk about was your change in sound and direction and style and things like that. And it's a weird thing when you do have a spotlight on you from when you've literally first started writing songs and making
music. And first started, like, having your own style, which is going to be different 10 years later.
So when I saw things start to change, I was like, oh, you've got into Hole and Bikini Kill and this kind of thing, which is, that's dope. That's that's absolutely fine. But if you've got a certain area that are saying, no, you need to be in a vintage dress and be twee or whatever else, then how is that? And how did you, again, my instinct would be that you would be someone who at first would rally against how you used to sound and maybe, do you know what I mean? Not be against Made of Bricks, but maybe want to step away from that.
Yeah.
Whereas now, a bit more grown up, embracing it all. Embracing the early you, the current you, all of it together, rather than because we all have that kind of. I always remember hearing Noel Gallagher slagging off his early music, and as a fan at the time, as a teen, I was like, "What's wrong with you? It's brilliant."
But
you go through those periods where you're sick of a certain song.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like it's also just to relate it to kind of everybody who's listening who isn't necessarily a musician. It's like, think about when you're 18, you're a teenager, you're carving out identity. You're obsessed with it. You're like, these are the posters on my wall.
Yeah.
This is what I wear. These are the people I hang out with. This is what I do on the weekend. And this is what I think the way the world should be. And, like, you know, that's how it's going to be forever. Yeah. Then you get into your 20s and you're like, I'm an adult now.
Yeah.
And I'm just an adult.
I can't believe I thought all that stuff.
Right? And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm 23. I'm so grown up. Like, I live on my own and I know everything. And then your world gets blown up like 1,000 times in your 20s. And you rebel against yourself, like, constantly. You just keep being like, oh, I'm going to, like, I have different friends. I have different life experience. I have different relationships. I have different clothes. My body's different. I feel different. Like, I have different goals. I just everything. And apply that then to me being in the public eye and the music industry. And I like to just put a bomb in things sometimes, blow it up, because... Yeah. Not to be self-destructive, I don't think, but just to be like, fuck you to anyone who's like telling me. I've always had a problem with someone telling me what to do.
Yeah.
I really have. Like, it's just like it's like I'm a stubborn child. Ask my mum. but I think that for a reason in this industry, I look back and I think that's fucking great. I'm like, good. You know what? I'm glad I set the fire alarms off at that big event because... Yeah. They were all cunts there. Like, I don't know. I just think it's kind of funny that I was like having this angst through these like big things and you know, my label telling me off and me being like, fuck you, running away. I'm like, great, okay, good. Yeah. I should have fucking done that.
Right,
good for you. And I definitely am now, you know, I never like hated my music or hated myself, but I was definitely shamed for who I was. I was talked to in a very condescending way by the media, by people in the industry. I was made a joke of, I was made fun of a lot. And I felt really self-conscious about that. And that was part of the reason I went to America, is because I felt very embraced there.
Yeah.
It wasn't, people in America aren't like, I don't know, there's not like this sort of like make fun of people in the same way culture. It's more like, you're an artist, I respect that.
Oh, we love to build them up and knock them down.
That's
over
what
here.
We do.
So
it's we love doing that.
And everyone forgets that if you start to be the person being built up, because it's great to be built up, right? It's lovely when people are like, oh, you're great. And it's like, oh, really?
But I feel like for me, it was in a really homegrown, beautiful way at first, where we were doing all these gigs that were growing and growing. I don't think I've ever been... I like to think I've never had a huge ego. I have an ego. I'm human.
Of course.
I've always had my sisters and my mum to, like, as soon as that starts flaring, line. They keep me in line, you know?
Perfect.
I mean, I'm a Nash. I can't... I get brought down by the Nashes quicker than anyone else could put me back on my... You know, if I ever started to act like that... I remember having arguments with my sister Helen, because she'd be like, you're acting like a dickhead. And I'd be like, what?
How dare you?
And then I was like, okay, well, maybe I am. Like, my sister is telling me that, and I would, like, listen to my family. And I've made mistakes, obviously. But for me, I never had comfort with... I never stood in front of paparazzi and felt, I love this. And you look back in photos, I look uncomfortable. Yeah, I still look like, oh, my God, I don't feel comfortable here. Still something that makes me nervous. I would run away from paparazzi. I was scared of that world. And I always felt bad there and like I didn't fit in. But it was like at gigs, you know, yes, I want to do the biggest shows I could do because I have huge like production ideas. I have amazing stage ideas. I'd love to see that grow more and more as I get older. But the fame always made me uncomfortable. But, you know, as I have gone through all of this turmoil, and then I got Glow. It's just so intertwined because are you into like astrology or anything?
Yeah, a bit. I've read on it. I'm no expert, right. And I'm not completely sold on everything. But
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I am because I mean not day to day crappy horoscopes and stuff, but we are all just like you know atoms, basically. We're just matter. We are physical matter. And that vibrates. And if you put a spoon over a flame, it gets hot. Why? Because all of the particles vibrate.
Yeah.
And that's why a spoon gets hot if you put it over a flame. So to me, to think that we are like, we're in a big ball that's floating in the middle of nowhere in space.
Yeah.
That's mental.
It's crazy.
That is insane.
Yeah.
So I'm game for anything, really, that like people have as beliefs. But
theories.
To me, science and planets and magnets and where the earth is, you know, when you're born, being pushed and pulled by different planets that are in orbit that come back into that same orbit and vibrate me in the same way that when I was born, that makes so much sense to me because I don't think I'm more than just physical matter, you know?
Completely, yeah.
And I'm affected by space. My period is connected to the moon, for goodness sake. I'm 60, 70% water. The moon controls the tide. I don't know. To me, it makes so much sense.
Yeah,
so I got my Saturn in return red right before I got Glow. And I was having all these weird, oh, my God, people.
You got your what, sorry?
It's called Saturn in return. That's when you're usually about 27 to 30. Yeah. That's why those years are, like, very turbulent for most people. And you usually get a pull of things that were in your earlier years come into your life in, like, a weird rush.
Right, wow.
And all these people were creeping up. I mean, I was getting freaked out by how much they were coming out. I was like, I can't deal with this. So that's why I spoke to my friend who can read charts. And he's quite cool because he's not very, he's not like very fairy. He's very like man of math and man of science. But he's like, this all makes total sense. It's like physics. Like, this is science.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what's going on with you. And he read my chart. And it just helped me kind of go, oh my God, this is like my personality. This all makes so much sense. And he was like, Saturn in return, it doesn't fuck about. It's going to be very literal. It's going to shock you how literal it is. This is going to bring you back to your roots.
Right.
That day, I went to Hair and Makeup and Glow, and they said, we're going to dye your hair red. And I was like, that could not be more fucking literal. Like, I'm going back to my roots.
Yeah.
And it was really emotional having my hair dyed red, and I realized how much I, like, how much I'd been affected by that bullying.
Yeah.
Because dyeing my hair and like playing bass and like changing things and gave me confidence to like get away from the girl that had been like treated really badly in relationships and
yeah.
by the business.
To feel like a different character or to become a different character as such, yeah, and not have to associate who you are now with yes. who they were picking on.
It wasn't quite that extreme, like character wise. I never felt like that, but it was definitely like, I don't want to be like that anymore. I don't want to be in that yeah. position. And I felt very vulnerable and very like hurt from that. So yeah. to be able to step away, anyway, to come back to it, I was like, oh my God, I'm not really ready to like look this person in the eye. And it's like looking at my younger self. And then my hair started to turn red, like in the chair. And I was looking in the mirror and I was like, this feels actually really good. And it feels really yeah. empowering. And what better way is there to like be brought back to your roots and to reclaim yourself in the ring with 14 women
yeah.
around you, learning to wrestle with Chavo fucking Guerrero. Yeah. I kind of thought, well, this is like one hell of a way to like reclaim
yeah,
yourself. Yeah,
100%.
And then, you know, I did Glow. Glow came out and then I did this Made of Bricks 10 yeah. year anniversary tour.
It's mad, isn't it?
Oh my God. It was just, it was like, it was a celebration of like love. It was like Christmas every day, that tour.
Yeah.
The crowd sang every word. I was going into these venues that were like evoking memories and I just felt like everything I'd worked on doing and that my open-heartedness and vulnerability, which sometimes I scolded myself for
yeah.
because I felt naive and how did I always just have so much empathy and trust all these people that screwed me over
yeah.
and keep doing that and stuff. I feel like, I'm like, aren't I supposed to become cold and shut down at some point? Like, maybe that's the right thing to do. But I feel like I just can't do that. And when I went into and saw these crowds and they were so open-hearted with me, I was like, that's why I've been so open.
Yeah.
And that this is the connection. And I sang these songs that I hadn't sung in, some of them I hadn't sung, I mean, Skeleton Song, and
yeah.
just pulled every single shit song I hadn't sung for years. Yeah. And, you know, it really made me go, like, that whole summer was about, like, valuing myself and loving myself, embracing who I am, every aspect of who I am, loving the me that went, fuck you, and, like, ran off into the crowd, and loving the me that, like, you know, wore vintage dresses and found my identity in yeah. that. And I am all those characteristics. I have that, you know, side of me that's very British and I love tea and like quaint countryside like things. And then I have like a punk aggressive fuck you side to me. And I have a version of me now that exists in the ring
yeah.
and wants to wrestle.
Yeah, yeah, completely.
And it was just such an amazing way to like face myself and learn to really value myself.
It's such a beautiful synchronicity because there's regardless of any fear or pressures, there's always a professionalism mm. and the fact is because of the role you got
yeah.
you had to turn back in
yeah
to, you know in time for the 10 year anniversary.
Oh my God, so I mean it was like meant to be. What the hell,
it might have been a really dramatic thing for you to have to do yourself if you know what I mean.
Oh
if
God,
you were
yeah.
coming up to that gig and going,
I don't think I would have done that. I don't think I would have done that.
It might have been too scary, but
yeah.
because they're just, no, you have to for this.
Yeah,
you're like,
yeah.
I have to for this. This yeah. is my role. I'm a professional.
Yeah.
It kind of, it forced that, which then, again, as yeah. stupid as it sounds, I guarantee that made the 10-year anniversary shows that bit more
Seriously.
Special. Because it's,
yeah.
it's Kate.
And
it's
we
that,
did.
It's the Made of Bricks Kate.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. we did sort of an homage to the original set, which
yeah.
I used to have like clouds and stuff
yeah,
and we
yeah,
brought
yeah.
out my old piano with all the light bulbs and we had like trees and clouds and
amazing
and like it was just like yeah and actually Skating Polly opened up for us
yeah
and Kelly who's in Skating Polly she reminds me of a younger me
yeah
and I saw this picture and I just thought, oh my God, is that, I thought someone had tweeted me a picture of one of my earlier gigs.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, wow, we really nailed the set, actually. And then I realised it was Kelly on stage and she had like red hair at the time and she does hair quite a lot. I just thought, wow, like, and I love her so much.
Yeah.
And she reminds me so much of me back then. And I'm like, that's what we need to do is we need to look at ourselves as kindly as we look to others.
Yeah.
You know, because we are taught to be self-deprecating and
100%.
And there's a difference between like, you know, I'm not going to ever be someone who's like, I'm I'm the shit, man. But in a way, I need to be like, yeah, I'm the fucking shit. You know? Yeah, yeah. Like, sometimes we need to tell ourselves, like, I'm good. I'm worth this. I'm valuable.
I wouldn't normally impose this upon someone, but I came up with my... I found my own life mantra about a year ago.
Great.
And it was just, I ain't shit. But also, I ain't shit.
Yeah.
And I think it just sums it up perfectly, because it's keeping that humbleness. It's keeping, I'm not
breaking
the world.
That's exactly what it is.
I've got this listener, I've got this role, I've done this gig. That doesn't matter. But also, there's a difference between humbleness and beating yourself up.
Totally.
And I think that can come from a lot of people who've started in working class or whatever areas where you're constantly trying to, I've got to stay humble. But what you're actually doing is, you're shitting on yourself a bit. You're beating yourself down.
We need to love ourselves. Like, that's really important. It's not talked about. And it's kind of seems, I don't know. It's kind of funnier to be down on yourself or whatever.
Yeah.
But that is the perfect mantra, because it's like, you know, I think the thing that I've learned, the wisdom I've gained, turned 30 last year. That was a big, you know, it's a big one to turn. It's like, put the flag down. And I realised, what I've learned is, I don't know shit. I don't know anything.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why my album's called Yesterday Was Forever, because when I was younger, you know, it was like that was going to be how things were forever.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you were in, that was like all you could see as your future. You're like, this is my plan and this is what I'm going to do, and I'm in this life and it's going to feel like this. And
I'm going to be a punk forever. I'm going to have padlocks around my neck and spiky hair and green hair. Obviously,
and you know,
why would I ever change that?
You could do that. You could do that forever. But what you envision is going to be surrounding you is going to constantly change.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're going to change. And you're going to have different people in your life and different jobs and different experiences and different feelings about things. And you should, because that means you're growing. And you're going to realise that, like, you don't know anything and you can decide this is your life. And life's going to be something completely different. And something can change in a second.
Yeah.
And that can be good or bad. And, like, to be just to know that, I think, is showing some wisdom. That's the wisdom I think I've learned from some life experience, is that I don't know anything.
Yeah.
It can all change in a day. And, like, and that reminds me of I ain't shit, but I ain't shit. Yeah. You know, I love that. I love that so much. I think it's perfect.
I'll wrap things up there, as we've had over an
hour. I'm totally going to use
that. I've taken loads of your time. It's a great...
I'm going to quote you, but I absolutely think it's brilliant.
I'll wrap things up by kind of saying that people, it's seen as an insult to say, oh, you've changed. That's often seen as a bad thing, but I'm delighted with that you've changed
in the
years we've not seen each other. And I look forward to all the changes that are ahead.
Same.
So
I think,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you for yours. It's been really nice.
You've been listening to Scroobish Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Kate Nash. And honestly, we could have talked for hours and hours on end. It was an absolute joy. I should mention that the Sam we referenced numerous times is Sam Duckworth of Get Kate, Wear Kate, Fly, who's going to be on the podcast soon for a little special that we're doing. Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to flag up was, I've looked into it now. Actually, I heard Eddie Temple Morris talking about it on the Hardcore Listening podcast, and the statistic was that if you're a female in the music industry, you're two-thirds... Hang on, I posted a video audio clip of it, so I've got it here, yeah. A female musician is three times more likely to kill herself than a male musician. In fact, I'll play you it. It's on my phone, so it's not going to be good quality, but...
A female musician is three times more likely to kill herself than a male musician.
Whoa.
And that is something that the UK music industry should feel ashamed about.
Yeah, so that was on the Hardcore Listening podcast, and the Hardcore Listening podcast is guests come on and choose their top five of anything, and Eddie chose his top five things he's eaten. But the beauty of the podcast is the top five focuses and gets people relaxed, and then the conversation goes off anywhere. And Eddie and myself have worked with Calm for many years, a suicide prevention charity and organisation. And yeah, depression and mental health and that kind of thing is something that's important to us a lot. And that was just an interesting stat that I heard on that. Again, we know that on the street it's reversed, or outside of the music industry. In general, overall, men are three times more likely
to commit suicide than women, but it's mad that within the music industry that's flipped on its head. And I think a lot of the stuff that me and Kate talked about and addressed here is kind of explains a lot of that. Some of the pressures. I mean, you only have to go on Lily Allen's Twitter to see the targeted abuse that she gets for being a woman with strong opinions that she's happy to express. And I know numerous musicians who are male who are as outspoken, if not more, who get a fraction of the kind of abuse that she gets. And yeah, the abuse often tends to end up being about her appearance, about previous paparazzi photos or whatever else, or any implications, anyone she might have had a relationship with, or any of these other things, which is no one's fucking business and completely okay. Yeah, it's an interesting one. Anyway, I will stop rambling and let the podcast end. Next week's guest is the return of one of the early podcast guests from back in the day, Mr. Simon Pegg. Oh, I should also mention, actually, if you've enjoyed this one, another person that we mentioned in a podcast was Amanda Palmer, who's a previous Distraction Pieces podcast guest, so go and check that out. But a previous guest as well is Simon Pegg, who was in the first 100 episodes, and he's on next week, so he's returning. So if you haven't caught the first one, go and listen to that, and the Nick Frost one, and maybe the Paddy Considine one, and who else? Michael Smiley. I'm trying to think anyone else who's in that crowd I've had on. I've had most of them. So yeah, go and check that out, and next week I'll have Simon Pegg on. I think it's next week. It might be the week after. I've got a lot recorded at the moment, so apologies if I miss any out. But thank you for tuning in. Yeah, and watch Glow on Netflix. I've adored it. I've watched the first five. I can't wait. I'll be honest, I've watched the first five because on the screener thing, I have to kind of watch on my laptop like when I've got the previews. So I've watched the first five and enjoyed them, but I'm waiting for it actually to come on Netflix. Partly, I want to add my viewing figures to their viewing figures. I know it's only one, but I believe in supporting things I like. So yeah, I'm waiting to watch the next five on Netflix on my TV rather than on my laptop. Too much information. That's not of any interest to any of you. Sorry about that. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next week. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.